Welcome to the Marketing Millennials, the No BS Marketing Podcast. I'm Daniel Murray, and join me for unfiltered conversations with the brains behind marketing's coolest companies. The one request I tell our guests, stories or it didn't happen. Get ready to turn the fuck up.
I think the most important thing right now, because of the rising acquisition costs to actually acquire a customer now in the first place, is to look at every aspect of that customer journey, not just the marketing to acquire them in the first place, and making sure that you're really honing in on giving that customer the best experience possible with your brand and your product to make sure that they're going to come back and buy from you again. Because we're no longer really living in a marketing world where a one-off order off of your acquisition cost is going to lead to long-term growth and profitability.
This episode is sponsored by Wistia. Wistia is the all-in-one video platform for business. With Wistia, you can create, host, and publish professional quality videos with nothing but a laptop. Try Wistia for free at wistia.com/millennials. What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of the Marketing Millennials. Today, I have Heather Horton on the podcast, and we're going to have a good conversation about rising customer acquisition costs and what to do and what not to do. But I would first like Heather to give a little few seconds on how she got into marketing and all that good stuff.
Hi, Daniel. Thanks for having me. Yeah, so I guess I didn't have kind of your traditional path into marketing. I started my degree at university studying chem and pharmaceuticals, actually, and very quickly learned through a Shakespeare class my freshman year that I wanted to switch my major over to English literature and creative writing. And before I'd even graduated, and this was, you know, in the early 2000s at the time, and SEO was just kind of starting to become a thing. And I started doing a lot of SEO writing and content writing, kind of as freelance stuff on the side. I was writing for a website called Cinema Blend as well, and kind of getting paid on a freelance basis for that. I moved over to the UK in 2009, and my first job that I had then was working for an automotive company, and I was doing all of their brand marketing, event marketing, that side of things. And it quickly became a social media marketing role, mainly because I was like, guys, why are we not doing anything on social media? As like the young, excited one in the office. Social media then led into email marketing. And then I moved over to a flooring brand, Carndean Design Flooring. I was their first digital marketing and consumer-based marketing employee there, and worked there for 6 years and built the digital marketing global team around me with a real focus on moving from a B2B focus as a business to consumer, and then started my agency at the end of 2017, which is an e-commerce focused agency. We kind of lead with consultancy and then deliver the services off the back of that.
I know something you're really passionate about is what to do, because we had a boom of great customer acquisition, low acquisition costs when we were in COVID, and then things quickly started scaling back up and efficiency started being the only thing that matters in marketing. So I want to first get into that. What should marketers be thinking right now as this is the state in the market right now?
I think the most important thing right now, because of the rising acquisition costs to actually acquire a customer now in the first place, is to look at every aspect of that customer journey, not just the marketing to acquire them in the first place, and making sure that you're really honing in on giving that customer the best experience possible with your brand and your product to make sure that they're going to come back and buy from you again. Because we're no longer really living in a marketing world where a one-off order off of your acquisition cost is going to lead to long-term growth and profitability. if you're going to be spending a lot more money to acquire that customer, they are going to have to bring back a bigger lifetime value for their brand. It needs to be about the second order, the third order, the fourth order, not just about that acquiring of the customer, getting one product sold, and then churning that customer. And this is something that when brands are now launching, if they don't look at their marketing spend and their acquisition costs in light of what that spend is against their lifetime value, they will very quickly either stop spending on marketing because there will be no ROI in that marketing or profitability and give up quite quickly on those channels, or they'll end up in a position where they run out of their cash very, very quickly because they went into it not realizing what they need to spend actually to get those first time orders and get those customers through and make sure that they're then following up on the other side to keep them loyal and coming back as well. And I think that's something we're talking about a lot right now at Equibox, is the funnel kind of changing and the funnel becoming more of an hourglass, because it's not just about funneling people through and getting them to make a purchase. You funnel them through, get them to make a purchase, and then the funnel builds out again for loyalty and lifetime value.
So knowing this, that you have to acquire, first of all, like a good customer that really has your pain or loves your product, or a customer that is a raving fan, what are some ways that you recommend people going about this? And what are some channels that you're seeing? I know obviously it's a maybe for every business what channels is, but what are some of the things that you are seeing as the best ways to acquire customers right now? And then I'll ask a follow-up question, like what are the best ways to like retain that customer, make sure that you build out the hourglass on the bottom?
It definitely does depend on the brand, and it depends on the product, the price point, the consumer. I think this is something that has to all be taken into consideration before you start promoting and putting your money into different channels, because we've seen a lot of hair care products, for example, or beauty products, whereby actually they don't have to put a huge amount of their money and effort into things like Meta advertising or Google advertising, because they can mainly push out through a large scale influencers project or doing it through TikTok social selling, because they're very demonstrable products. So you can show what the product does, what the before and after is. And if the price point isn't too much for that consumer to part with, then obviously they can get sales very quickly through those channels. Whereas with some of the more luxury brands that we work with, or high-end clothing brands, where people are going to have to think a little bit more about the purchase before they make it, and they're very unlikely to make that purchase on the first visit, or furniture, sofas, that kind of thing, a bigger purchase, it is more important to spread your budget and your focus across a lot of different channels to build up those touch points and make sure that you're capturing their email address at the right time. You're following up with emails. You're targeting them with the right kind of ads, with reviews and more information to get them to consider that purchase. And that cycle takes a little bit longer.
I think that's a great point. I think first you got to realize, is your product an impulse buy product, or is it something that is like a more of a something you have to think about, more of something that's a maybe a present, more than something that you have to, someone has a part with a lot of money? And then also the big thing when looking at channels is what is the margin on that product, because sometimes you can spend a lot. For example, like beauty has a high margin because it's easy to ship, it's smaller products, like margin on beauty is very good, but like some products have very, very low margin. So you can't blow your money on a channel that is an impulse buy channel. You have to figure out something, or it could be a great channel for you if you can sell in bulk, but you have to figure out those things, like what type of channels are these buyers, what are the buying behaviors of these channels, and then figuring out, what are my margins? How much can I actually spend to acquire a customer? And then figuring out all those things. But that makes, you make a good point, is just you have to figure those things out first, and then you can be like, okay, maybe Meta is good for my brand. Oh, TikTok might be good for my brand because we know there's a lot of TikTok impulse buyers on those channels. We should go after those people.
And it's also really thinking about, like, where are my customers? What platforms are my customers spending their time on? And we've seen a lot of brands who have just assumed that going for Meta advertising made sense for them. And actually, when they looked at their data, majority of their spend was going into Facebook, but actually their audience is more likely to be on Instagram. And it's just making sure that you don't let the algorithms take charge of where your budget is being spent as well, because a lot of mistakes and wastage happens there as well.
What's amazing about the era of paid advertising is you can use a small budget to do micro tests to just see, is this where my audience is? Is this messaging? Obviously, you can also do the heavy lifting up front, which most brands should do, and just figure out and talk to people and see where they hang out, and which most people don't like to do, which you could do that as well. But it's also great, we're in an era that you don't have to go put out an expensive TV ad and figure out, is this going to work or not?
I love the return of market research, Daniel.
Yeah, return of market research, return of creativity, return. There's pendulums do swing in marketing. And for example, like when Meta went high and all that stuff, that means more people were spending on Meta. That means there were channels that were left that people could capture up, like billboards or direct mail, stuff like that. There were channels that people were not thinking about that people go and capture the low-hanging fruit in that market.
We've seen a real resurgence of direct mail working, to be honest. I think it's one of those things whereby if you're getting flooded with direct mail all the time, you're likely to ignore it. But we kind of stopped getting flooded with direct mail at some point. So now we pay more attention to it again when it comes through.
I think we got flooded back in the day. And then now it's just like, oh, we got a letter. This is so cool. Like, why are we getting a letter in the mail?
This send me something.
Someone sent me something in the mail. They took time to do it. It shows like time. I want to go to the other part though.
Loyalty.
Figuring out the customer acquisition, your customer acquisition channel is obviously key. Figuring out how to convert those people, obviously key. We could talk a little bit about that in a little bit too, like how to convert them down the funnel. But then obviously the point you were making before is how do we keep these people loyal, get them back, retain them? Because it's easier to not get a new customer, it's easier to retain an existing customer. So what are some ways that people can think about doing this?
Yeah, so I think one of the most underrated areas of marketing, which a lot of people don't think is marketing, is actually your customer service and your logistics side of your business. That experience of the packaging, the opening of the product, how the product actually looks, feels, anything that comes in the box, that's almost just as important as the shopping experience and adding to cart and actually buying that product in the first place. On top of that, any interactions that the user has with customer service, either while they're shopping or afterwards, your returns messaging that you have on your website, help guides, FAQs, the signals that actually go through the checkout to make sure that you know that what you're purchasing is secure and it's going to arrive on time, et cetera. These are all things that are going to make sure that that customer has the best experience possible with your brand, which is then therefore going to make them more likely to buy from you again. But it's not as simple as that, because if I've bought from you and I've had an amazing experience, great. I may talk about it to my friends, or if I'm wearing your product or using it, I'll definitely refer it because I like that product. But in order to get me to convert with you again and buy again, you either need to start actively targeting me with ads or emails that have other products that would be of interest to me, or have a really strong product development cycle whereby you are going to be regularly introducing new collections and new products that I am therefore going to want to buy. And I think this is something that needs to be thought about before you start spending money on acquiring customers, because we have worked with and we've seen a lot of brands who have launched with kind of single SKU products. And that whole idea of lifetime value kind of goes out the window with all you're relying on is for that customer to buy once and then refer to friends. That's only going to get you so far. If you don't have new product development in the pipeline, further products that that same customer is going to be interested in and buy, it is very, very hard to keep that customer because they're not going to keep coming back and necessarily buying the same thing from you over and over again. Unless it is, as we said, you know, a cream or skincare or beauty product, that kind of thing. But it's very rare.
Two things on that is, one is, like, is this a replenishable product? Is it how replenishable is the product? Like, obviously, in the beauty industry, you can have replenishable products and then products that could sit there and someone uses for months and months and you're not going to replenish. There's also, like, cookware brands that you only need one pan for 3 years. So are you going to go buy another cookware? Those are the type of things you have to think about. Otherwise, you have to go with the bulk play. But it's always good because it also, when you have other SKUs, you could do things top of funnel, like bundling and packaging, and to up the order value as well, which also helps in the long run for acquiring that customer. So that customer acquisition cost goes down when you acquire a customer for an order value of, say, 200 versus like 80.
100% agree. And we really like to work with brands as well where they have a range of different kind of products and pricing, because there tends to be, especially with the more thoughtful purchases and the more expensive brands, you need to have something that you're selling on your site that's a little bit easier to purchase and a little more attainable to get someone into the brand in the first place. And then hopefully they'll come back and stay longer term. Same thing with brands that are on a subscription basis. If you want lifetime value out of a subscription product, for example, if you're selling vitamins or you're selling shampoo that you want on a subscription, having some sort of mechanism whereby you pay less for, say, a free trial or your initial order, and then the subscription carries on. These are really good mechanisms to lower your acquisition costs for a customer who will have a good experience and then stay with you long term.
You really see any of, like, the marquee, like, e-commerce brands have one SKU? It used to be a thing back in the day where you a one SKU brand, you know, you can dominate that one SKU, and that's the only SKU you have. I mean, it's way easier for a marketer to sell one SKU, but we're not in that era of one SKU anymore. But it's something you need to think about upfront, that when you're making a product, that especially in e-commerce where we said before, but margins are harder than a traditional SaaS brand or a software brand. You have to think about all these little things that you only could sell it once. I had to sell it in bulk. That means I had to spend more, but, and I had to be really efficient, really, really, really efficient with my spend if I only have one SKU. So do I need to think about doing multiple SKUs before I start launching a site, or all these things you have to think about way ahead of even launch of the product?
I mean, look at some of the mattress brands that came out as well in the 2020s, the ones that came out around COVID. You had Simba, Emma, and all these mattresses that you could get in the post. I mean, how often do we buy a new mattress? Talk about a one-off purchase there. And recently, a lot of those have been struggling, which you can tell by the massive price cuts.
Yeah, even like shoe brands that only had a couple of SKUs, not many people are just going to buy, let's say, love it, they're not going to buy 10, 20 pairs of shoes, or they're going to maybe references.
Unless you're my 11-year-old who's obsessed with Jordans.
Or yeah, but Nike has a bunch of SKUs to be able to, but some of the like newer shoe brands or the newer clothing brands came out with one or two.
Very small lines.
Unless you have something coming out in 3 to 6 months that is cooler, better, improved, it's harder to get that customer to come back and make another purchase.
Absolutely.
Making videos can be a hassle. You have to do 100 takes. Editing is super complicated. and finding music is a pain. That's why we love Wistia. With Wistia, you can record yourself, your screen, or both. Edit videos like you edit Google Docs. Just highlight words and hit delete. Wistia even has music that auto-adjusts to the length of your video. Try Wistia for free at wistia.com/millennials. That's wistia.com/millennials.
So there's a couple of things you should think about in this efficiency era. I'll go to one topic first that I know you are also passionate about, but is collecting more first-party data, having more data in your, and not relying on these third parties to grow your business. What are some ways you can start collecting first-party data? What are some ways that brands are doing it wrong right now and they're not getting any first-party data and they should start rethinking about that?
As you know, our industry really started focusing on this whenever Apple started locking down cookies and blocking third-party cookies. And then obviously Chrome have delayed it a couple times and Google to actually block the usage of third-party cookies. But this has meant that the power that brands really have now is the power of building their own walls around their communities and honing in on their own customer data, because we're not really going to be able to use the data from what people are doing on other sites. We need to get to know who they are ourselves. And this is something that I've been explaining a lot to the brands and the customers that we work with, because there are obviously really good ways to get customers to sign up for email. I think any marketer will recognize that the classic one is get 10% off your first order if you sign up for our email list, which has been done to a point now that I don't think people will even place a first order from a new brand unless they get a welcome code or a discount code, because it's just expected now. But obviously, there are a lot of other ways to generate data as well. I think the best way that we've found has definitely been through lead generation campaigns with useful content. So, for example, we work with a nappies brand called Kitten Kin. They're an eco diaper brand, wipes brand, etc. And they have created a lot of useful content for first-time parents, things that are about, you know, packing your hospital bag for when you're delivering your baby, or useful things like size guides, when to size up the diaper, etc. That content has really worked well, especially on Meta lead gen campaigns, to deliver email addresses for quite cheap. Other things as well that we're looking at and getting more email addresses from is just really improving account areas on websites. So I think the days of sign up for an account on our website just because you purchased something are kind of gone. There needs to be something that you get out of that account area, because otherwise I'm not going to sign up and create a profile or create a login, because it's just another login I'm going to have to remember and I'm going to have for your site. So looking at actual useful functionality in the account area beyond just tracking your order is something that can also help you to build up that first party data. I think the other thing as well is there's a lot of businesses out there that are still relying on Amazon as a core channel for selling their products. And that's great. Now it can bring in a huge amount of revenue for you. But not only are you going to be paying a much bigger margin to Amazon than you would if you were acquiring that customer through your own brand website, but also Amazon owns that customer and not you. And you obviously don't have that data to then go back to that customer and email them. So any brand that is relying heavily on Amazon right now should definitely be looking at whatever they can put into D2C to make sure that the only buyers they're getting on Amazon are the people who are just straight up Amazon buyers, and you're not going to get them to buy elsewhere because that is where they prefer to purchase.
Being on Amazon is more of a brand play, and two, because a lot of people, it's good to be going to Amazon and say, search for X product, your product is actually there. Otherwise, they're just going to start funneling to whatever competitor you have. So it's good to have an Amazon, but you're completely right. You can't just neglect building your own channels. That might be is the harder move usually, is building your own channels. But think of Amazon as just capturing existing demand that already exists on Amazon platform. And then the rest is you creating demand outside of it to figure out how, because once those Amazon clients maybe realize there's a unique SKU maybe on your D2C website or something that they can't get on Amazon that they only can get or on your website, then they can start being like, oh, maybe I'll go shop. My wife is in D2C, so she's a chief growth officer at a e-commerce agency in the United States, but she is like tried and true, like, I'm going to go to the site and find that, buy it from straight from the D2C side, unless the D2C side just absolutely rips you off if you go there. So that's why you have the, but mostly it's better to buy directly from brand one and helping those small business brands out more. It's like the same thing. I know here we have DoorDash out there that Deliveroo, but like you buy from Deliveroo, those are just really marketing tools for restaurants. So they're not the same. It's better to actually place an order at that restaurant or with that restaurant because they're not losing margin and stuff like that. They're trying to get a first time purchase on that and get discovered on that platform. That's why they're on it. And then they're figuring, like, it's way better for you. They're hoping you would go back and to the store or go back to order from them. That's their hope. It doesn't usually happen that way, but that's their hope.
The issue with Deliveroo, though, is they've just made it so easy, haven't they? It's so easy
to make an order
and all of your data.
Amazon is the same. Yeah.
Same with Amazon.
The shipping is so easy. You get shipping easily. It's one-click checkout. You don't have to make accounts. You already have an account. So just they made it really an easy experience. And then the opposite is the buyer expects the same for you as a brand. So they expect a good shipping, fast shipping, easy buying experience. So you have to think about that when you're building a brand that there's already an expectation in the market for that is set. And it's kind of something you have to do now to win.
I completely agree with you. And actually, in order to compete with platforms like Amazon, you need to make sure that the experience of shopping directly through your brand, the website, the journey, and also every touch point that you have with customer service are helping you to find the product really differentiates you from just going and pointing and clicking on Amazon. And I think that brands are doing this really well right now with storytelling, quizzes, shopping guides, and content that they have on their site. And that is going to help them stand out against, you know, aggregate shopping channels.
So you were saying that for beauty brands, for example, they have great influencer programs that are driving their brand, but there's also a negative side of influencer marketing that, and there's some stuff you should not do in that space. So what are some things that you should avoid as a brand when, or think about twice when going into influencer marketing?
Influencers, content creators, you know, UGC, that side of things. Obviously, it is so important for brands to get that mix right. The days of working with influencers just because they have millions of followers and assuming that the sales are going to come off the back of that have kind of gone now. You need to have a true audience and brand fit with an influencer. It needs to be really believable that they actually would use or wear your product and they actually would be a fan for it to come across as genuine to their audiences. And just giving people freebies just to get them to promote your product, I don't think is a massive benefit anymore for brands. I think they were spending a lot of money on these posts and I think they were working at one point. But then once you had one or two posts from those influencers, you then weren't getting the same return afterwards. You know, you'd have a big burst, you'd get two really big posts out there and get good sales, and then it would just fall apart after that. I think the great thing about UGC and content creators, though, is very often they have a much smaller following but actually they can be a lot more effective for you as a brand because they come across as a lot more genuine. And actually what you find with UGC as well is that reusing content from your real customers and showing that real side of how your product is worn and loved and truly reviewed by people who have found that product themselves tends to work a lot better and come across more genuine when you're reusing it in your advertising.
The best influencers are usually consumers of the product that also use social media. That's usually the best influencers to work with, people who are generally using your product in the as a natural thing. And you see this all the time, that like Charlie D'Amelio and Duncan and all these things where they were naturally using the product before. I mean, that's a great idea if you're a big brand and you see a brand, an influencer doing that. If you're a small brand and someone's saying, oh my goodness, I drink this drink every day as my drink of choice, and they naturally saying that, and they're not even saying like not sponsored here, I'm actually doing this, then it's a great way to be like, oh, this is a good time to send them product, or this is a good time to send them something.
Exactly. They're already a fan. They're already talking about you. Jump straight in there afterwards. But a lot of influencers now have gotten on to the fact anyway that they can create their own brands and create their own products. And that's, you know, a whole new world that we're in now. The Kardashians all have their own brands, very, very successful brands that they're selling to their communities that have come off the back of community-driven ideas that they've had. I mean, Skims for Kim Kardashian basically came off the back of her community asking her all the time when she was posting photos of herself, where's your shapewear from? So she just created her own, you know, because why promote somebody else's shapewear when she could sell her own brand? But, you know, I think that that's another reason why the whole influencer marketing world is kind of shaking up now, because we have gotten to a point where it is about trust, and brand trust is really important, and consumers can see through when it's not.
Yeah, new. It worked before because it was new. Everything new, usually when you're early to something, is going to work. And then eventually consumers are smarter than you think and actually see through the lines. I think the only way it does work is if that influencer does have a tried and true following, that influencer does have raving fans. Like I know, for example, my wife has like 6 influencers. If they wear a product or they use a product, she's automatically adding to cart. But there's also, there's one off that you see in the feed that me as a user get fed the content. I haven't built trust with that influencer yet. It's still coming up on my feed. It might be a good brand awareness play, but it's not going to get me to purchase because I haven't got any brand affinity with that person yet.
It's also about if that influencer is going to have the right following and audience for that product that you're selling as well. Like I'm sure those 6 influencers that your wife works with are amazing and could literally sell anything to anyone. But if they didn't have the right audience kind of following them for that product that they're selling, like the Snoop campaign with the smokeless grills, which I talked about on my TikTok recently, it's not going to work anyway because it's going to hit the wrong people and it's just not going to sit right.
Like the Get Ready With Me influencers, for example, I mean, they obviously, you're going to buy things that are like makeup and stuff like that. You're not going to, if they start promoting like a grill, it's not going to work. Why are they talking about that grill right now? That's where it's like the natural. You have to figure out how to naturally place your product. It's done for years. Like it's been done in movies for years. Naturally, product placement in movies is done. You just got to figure out how to naturally insert your product into a natural environment where it belongs, not just in a random in the wild and hope it works. The last question I have to ask you is, what is a marketing hill you would die on?
I'm seeing a lot of small brands who are spending money on out-of-home advertising. So things like tube advertising in London or bus stop advertising. I really struggle with this because I think about the amount of money that out-of-home advertising costs and what you're spending on that, and actually the amount of wastage that you have for all the people that you're reaching who are completely irrelevant to your brand. And being a digital marketer and a D2C person, that kind of like kills me a little bit, because the amount of money that they're spending putting it into digital advertising could return a much bigger ROI for them, actual visitors to their website, building up their cookie pools, people who actually would become customers. I would absolutely die on the marketing hill of do not spend money on above the line out-of-home advertising unless you've completely nailed and you're topped out on the spending that you're putting into digital marketing channels.
Yeah, I mean, it's something to add your mix once you've got something going, but it's not something you should be saying is a tried and true thing.
Don't start there. Don't advertise, you know, in Times Square before you're running ads on Meta.
I totally agree. I mean, I think more sometimes that's also like sometimes it's an ego play because they want to see their brand everywhere. But yeah, I think, I mean, if that is your audience, the average tube taker, they could be, if it's like a commuter product or something that like will help their commute or something like that, maybe that's a great way, just a great place for you. But you have to, like you said, like really understand, well, how many of my audience commute, how many of my audience commute actually look up and see that and make a purchase. And then eventually it might be.
And how are you going
to
track it?
Eventually it might be something you add to your mix. I think it's not a bad idea to add something to your mix once you've got a stable CAC payback, once you got a stable, like, you have a funnel.
Agreed.
Yeah. Once the funnel's working, you can start doing those type of things. Unless we said before at the beginning, this is really your audience, then maybe spend a little bit there.
I think it'd be very rare that would be the best place to put your money, but I will give you that there may be some. Yeah,
there might be one or two products out there that might work for that. Lastly, where can people find you and what you're doing?
You can find me on LinkedIn. You can also find me on TikTok, Heather Horton Equibox, and our website is equibox.com.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast, sharing your ideas, sharing your knowledge. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Daniel.
Thanks so much for listening. Tune in next week to hear more great insights from marketing's coolest operators. If you haven't already, please consider subscribing to the Marketing Millennials podcast and giving it a 5-star rating. It helps bring more marketers into our community.